welcome back to Living on the Edge. This is your podcast for all things related to Kubernetes, developer tooling, API gateways, service mesh implementation, and more. Let's get into it.
Hello, welcome to the Living on the Edge podcast. I'm your host, Kay James, and today we're joined by Krishna Modi, who is a cloud engineer at Cisco. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Kay. It's an awesome feeling to be on this podcast. I've been following your podcast, by the way. I've been following last few of them. It has been quite interesting, and it's a pleasure to be on this podcast today.
Yeah, glad to have you. So why don't we start with just a little brief introduction of who you are and some of your background?
Okay. Well, there's not much to talk about me. I think it's a very simple thing about me that I am from Mumbai, India. I work at Cisco. I've been working at Cisco since a year. And apart from that, of course, I've worked on with various companies like Hewlett Packard Enterprises. By the way, this is my second time with Cisco. And I work with startups like there's PharmEasy, which is into the healthcare. I think that's majorly about me. But about my interest, I would like to tell you that I am very keen on the cloud native space, the infrastructure, cloud automation, particularly DevOps, SRE, platform engineering, and whatever next that is coming up, DevOps, DevSecOps, and more forms of it, right? And I think dev AI ops, I don't know, so many things. So yeah, that's mostly about me. I keep writing blog posts on Medium, on various other platforms. There's something written on DigitalOcean. And I'm also a contributor to some of the GitHub repositories, one of them being Ambassador. And there's a very old one, which is OpenStack. I was one of the contributors in the Ironic service, which is for the OpenStack bare metal provisioning. I keep doing those overall. So that's majorly about me.
Cool. So what kind of inspired that leaving Cisco, coming back? Was that like you were trying to just gain new knowledge and you're like, actually, I want to go back, or that sounds really interesting. So what was that about?
Yeah, I think that's a quite interesting question. And it's a very interesting part of my career's journey, let's say. When I was earlier at Cisco, I was a network consulting engineer, and I was handling this account, which is a European telecom customer that we have. So it was quite interesting to learn about the entire networking space, and Cisco being one of the leaders in networking. But I really wanted to be more hands-on development, try out my hands on various technology stack. And so it's always good to start. I mean, a lot of my mentors have told me that it's always good to start with an enterprise, a big company, where a multinational company, where you actually understand the process, you learn the process, you learn the systems, and then get into a startup where you actually get to experiment out of the box. Maybe you don't have limits, you don't have boundaries, and you actually try out various things into various departments. So let's say you are handling end-to-end systems. And that's what I did. After a year at Cisco, I really wanted to be more hands-on, try a various stack, because usually when you start your career, you're focused on one vertical or one technology. But when you get into when you start moving to up your ladder, let's say like a senior software engineer or something, you would want to have more skills in your resume, let's say. So that's when I thought of moving to two different startups where I actually gained a lot of knowledge. And with this skill set, when I'm back at Cisco, I think I'm much more respected. I'm much more able to contribute to that particular organization as well. So I think I was destined to be back at Cisco, but with just more knowledge and more experience. I think that's what drove me back. And Cisco has always been one of the best cultures, company having the best cultures, and always a family. By the way, just one fun fact. Cisco has this term called boomerang, and it's very often with Cisco that a lot of people who leave Cisco, they come back and join Cisco. So I'm one of the boomerangs.
That's actually really interesting. I didn't know about that. So what is like Cisco's perspective on the landscape of cloud? Like, are there any exciting things that your team is working on specifically that you could mention, or just in general with Cisco?
Oh, that's a very interesting question, I tell you. So, okay. about this, let's talk about so what I call the current movement at Cisco, I call it NVIDIA moment, right? So NVIDIA has positioned itself differently currently in the market. NVIDIA calls itself the AI computing company, right? So it's starting from the GPU and just the gaming laptops and the GPU graphics card processing company, they've completely repositioned themselves as the AI computing company. And that's what I think Cisco is also trying to do. So what NVIDIA does is anyone wants to use machine learning and machine learning AI or whatever it is, which is the trend, everyone can do that. But all of them become my customer because I will provide you the hardware. So whoever it is, Google's of the world or Microsoft of the world, they still rely on NVIDIA for the hardware, right? Similarly, and for that matter, so similarly, what Cisco wants to do is whatever cloud computing platform do you use, right? Any platform that you use, I am the cloud native service provider for you. So anything that you use, you will still need observability. You will still need security. You will still need traceability and so many different tools, right? So any kind of product that you use, you always will have to rely on Cisco for some of the enterprise's products. So that's the best bet that anyone can do. So just like NVIDIA calls itself as the AI computing company, I would say Cisco would soon call itself the cloud native company or cloud observability company, right? And that's where it is aiming at. So I'll take some more time into this. Let's say, let's talk about the recent acquisitions by Cisco. And one of the very famous ones or very popular ones is Splunk. It's a $28 billion in cash deal, right? And the beauty of this is the largest ever acquisition by Cisco. Splunk has been the largest ever acquisition by Cisco. And see, there's always Elastic as a company, which is always a competitor, which has always been a competitor of Splunk. But Elastic is a developer's tool. It's a developer's company, whereas Splunk is an enterprise platform. You can actually plug into Splunk and it's available for you to use from day zero or day one, let's say, right? So for Cisco to buy that and then moving on to the next one, Isovalent, right? And also Cisco has more products, like there is Intersight, there is AppDynamics, all of these products combined together. It positions Cisco very well into the observability market, into the cloud native product suite that it is trying to offer. And so there's a big difference as per the every other company. So Cisco has always been trying to market to the trying to serve to the enterprise community, enterprise companies, all the big businesses, right? Fortune 500 or even more than that. So the tools that I'm talking about or the acquisitions that Cisco has been doing recently are all positioned towards the enterprise market. And that puts Cisco in a very well position. I'm getting a bit into the business side where this improves the total ARR, annual recurring revenue of Cisco, which of course impacts the stock markets and a lot of other things. But let's put that all aside. In the technology space, the kind of work that Cisco is doing in the cloud world is quite amazing. And of course, that all boils down to each and individual, every individual team that is there. So I am part of something called supply chain organization. And I think supply chain is something where cloud is not very actively used because of course it is in-house, internal operations entirely. So we have on-prem servers, but that's also a private cloud. And we are able to use a lot of these tools internally as well. And it's quite beautiful. I mean, I would love to show you someday just the beauty of the platforms and how things move from one to another seamlessly. So that's something I think where Cisco is positioning, and that's what we're working on recently, I would say.
Cool. Yeah, that was very informative. I did not know about some of those acquisitions. So it's really cool to hear how Cisco is trying to kind of take over the cloud native space in that way. Super interesting. Let's get into identity access management a little bit. Do you have any tips or best practices in that area that developers should be thinking about?
Yeah. So I think identity and access management, let's call it IAM, is I think everyone's problem. You start any company, you start any product, IAM has always been the first problem, right? So what I would suggest, there are two things that I would say, right? First, if you're starting anything, do not start without IAM. Start with IAM from D1. Secondly, do not write IAM. It is very old-fashioned to write your own IAM now. There are so many tools available. There's so much of tooling available. There's so much of SaaS products, open source products available. So I think those days are gone when you write your own IAM, because even the identity and access management has become a lot more complex. It is not just you create a user, you authorize a user, and it just works. It's not just restricted to that. There's a lot more, right? So you never use, never write your own IAM anymore. I don't think so. You should do that. It's just a waste of a lot of time. Of course, you can do that at a much later stage, but to begin with, you should never write your own IAM. There's so many tools. I think to start with, there is KeyClock by Red Hat, which is one of the best tool I've seen, and it's very easy to integrate. It has always been API friendly and integration friendly, right? And let's say if you want to get into the paid side of world, JumpCloud is my favorite. The way JumpCloud has positioned itself, it is the offering is very unique and is very seamless. I think it's more than developer friendly. It is everyone friendly. It's a user friendly. It's a very amazing platform. I like that. So apart from this, the tips that I had, I think there are five basic fundamentals that everyone should follow in an IAM. Right? Let's say even if you're writing, there is AAA, which is authentication, authorization, and audit. This has to be from day one. Whenever you're writing or whenever you're outsourcing, I mean, using an existing tool, make sure that these three things are there. Apart from that, there are two more things I usually suggest. I mean, AAA is a very basic framework. But apart from that, there are two more things that I always suggest. One is to have a central user repository. A lot of times I see startups writing microservices and they are spreading their users across microservices, which is a big pain when they have to consolidate these microservices for any of the operations on the user. So let's get into the security side of things, where you want to hide the personally identifiable data, right? So all those things, it becomes very big challenge. So it's always good to have a central repository. And the fifth point, which I have, is the very important one, apart from AAA and central user repository, is to start with a multi-tenant user. I think a lot of times, let's talk about AWS. When you have a user in AWS, you don't have just a user. I mean, you always want to have multiple accounts in AWS, and you also want to jump between different users. Like even in Google, right? If you just log into Google, you would want to jump between different organizations that you have or different products that you have, right? So a lot of companies, they have different business units and they have different accounts for them. So you want to have a common user across these accounts. So have cross organizational users, have multi-tenant users. These are the things I think you should think about them from the beginning of IAM. This is a very important tip that I have. This 5 points: AAA, central user repository, and multi-tenant users or cross organizational users. That's my tip. Apart from, don't start without IAM and don't write your own IAM. Apart from that.
Yeah, those are some great tips. I guess like going down that security standpoint, I like that you said like start with IAM, right? What other aspects of security do you think people should kind of put first when it comes to the cloud world?
I think security is a very broad space, and there is always a catch up that we are doing. I mean, let's say you've covered all your vulnerabilities and everything, but there was Log4j that came up, which disrupted the entire security space. So I think there's always a catch up that we have to do. The best way to be secure is, I think one of the things that you should definitely look at is not just secure yourself from the external threats, but also from the internal threats. And to do that, I think the most important piece is observability, or having enough visibility into the security threats. So let's say, how does an attack happen, right? So let's say when an attack happened, what does an attacker do? Attacker can do two things. One is either he will expose the data, so export the data out, or delete the data within. Let's say I get into your laptop. What I can do is either I can download the data from your laptop, so I steal the data, or I delete the data from your laptop. So to trouble you, basically, that's the two things. So about deleting the data, there's always backups that can always help you, right? So that's how you can secure yourself in a way. And it could also be an internal user. Let's say you yourself come in or someone else logged into your laptop, which had your password, and he deletes the data. So your backups will help you to be secure from them. That's what the organization is. I'm working at Cisco, and let's say if I delete a database at Cisco, intentionally or unintentionally, the backups might help me. But what if someone wants to dump the data out, right? If I'm downloading the data. So that is where I think in the networking space, in the network area, if you can monitor the traffic that is incoming and outgoing, limit your ports, understand what traffic is coming in and going out with a single source, then I think it is very easy to identify that and even block those things. And if you do that, I think that's a core way of securing internally as well as externally. And once you've done that, I think overall, there's a lot more thing that you have to do. But overall, attack is of, as I said, there's two intentions of attack, either delete or dump. So this is how you can also safeguard yourself from the dump. And there's always catching up that you can do. That's another space.
Are there any tools, maybe like in the IAM side specifically, or just in general when it comes to cloud security that you think are doing it like right? Like you mentioned KeyCloak is one of them. Are there any others that you think are really the best of the best right now?
In the IAM space, right, particularly, I think I mentioned about JumpCloud. I also talked about KeyCloak, but I think there's a lot of them. Like, you can always start with as simple as a Firebase authentication API or use AWS's Cognito. There's so many other options like that. And each one of, or there is Auth0 and so many other things, right? And I think each one of them have their own benefits or drawbacks or feature set. So I think it's more about evaluating your use case and finding the best match. I always find KeyCloak to be the easiest and the safest option because of the feature set and everything. But of course, it may be overwhelming for some of the folks. You might just want to use something like a Firebase or just get done with it by outsourcing the entire IAM. So I think it's more about the requirement and the use case, and there's definitely tons of tools available. So I don't think there is anything particularly I would like to name here apart from the few names I've already given.
Cool. And you've written for Ambassador Labs. You've mentioned, contributing to our repositories a little bit. Are there any trends in security and API gateways specifically that you're interested or excited about?
I think the API gateway has been one of the most interesting journey that we've seen. I think it has always been in the area of API gateway. I think it has always been about adapting the Netflix's architecture. I mean, Netflix was one of the first companies to start with the microservices. Then they had the monolith, which they tried to divide into microservices. Then after from microservices to a gateway, and now they have a federated gateway. And then the GraphQL APIs, right? So the kind of the overall journey in the API gateway for Netflix. So that's what a lot of people loved, and they've tried to mimic it with, let's say, Ambassador, with different API gateway services, I think. And the gateway API for Kubernetes, that particular paradigm, I think that's one of the best I've seen. I think the ingress controller phase, which was there, it is slowly going away, and the gateway API is a much more matured and much more opinionated way of doing the entire gateway API approach, where it understands the cloud native way. It understands that the communication is HTTP based or TCP based, or it could be more protocols. So understanding those and facilitating accordingly, understanding that there are security requirements, like you have HTTPS, or there could be more HTTP 3 or 4 or 5 coming up. There is authentication, there is middleware, there is rate limiting. So creating a framework around it and making sure that these are all easily pluggable is much better with API gateway, the gateway API with Kubernetes. So I think that's one of the best trend that I'm liking as compared to the traditional ingress, where ingress gives you a very limited functionality, and then you always have to fall back to some external ingress providers, like of course Nginx, and there's Kong, there's of course Ambassador, where Ambassador again took a very different route of using that ingress but shaping it and forming it like an API gateway. So it actually performed like an API gateway. And I think Ambassador has a very big contribution in how the entire gateway API has been structured, because I see the structure to be very similar to how Ambassador has created the API gateway format, the CRDs and everything. And gateway API actually has taken a lot of insights from that as compared to anything else. So I think that's one of the best thing that I really like about gateway API. And the recent one, which is Envoy gateway, I think that's the final one. I think once Envoy gateway is, and I think there's a stable release already there, I hope so. But once Envoy gateway is full of features, it's once it has all the features, basic features required, once it has available, I think it's the end of every other API gateway. I think that will be the de facto one. I really love the kind of development they've done, the kind of maturity they're bringing from ground up, from the beginning of the structure. Plus, one of the things I really like about API gateways is now observability is also part of API gateway. So we've always seen routing, monitoring, and basic monitoring, and rate limiting, security, those aspects. But observability, without actually getting into the application, you can actually just use the API gateway to monitor your application altogether. It's a much lesser intrusive way, or almost non-intrusive way, to get the entire observability captured, like traceability, capture everything, right? You're able to determine your SLOs, your NTTRs, and so many other metrics out of it. So that's one of the best trends, I think, in the API gateways.
So you also do a bit of writing on like Medium and things like that. You've written for Ambassador Labs. Could you talk a bit about some of the things that you've written about and maybe anything that you're currently writing about and working on?
Well, I'm currently working on a very different space. I don't think that's something a latest technology, but it's quite interesting for me. This is basically robotic process automation, or I'll call it web browser automation for using Selenium framework, right? So there's a lot of times we've seen that data compliance requires a lot of putting a data, manual entries, making sure that your physical data center and your actual virtual view of the data center are not in place. Let's say you have a rack or a server at a particular location, but that's not really represented in your diagrams or in your databases. So capturing that, filling this data in with several tools and everything integrated together, that's something I'm working on. So I think that's much different than the cloud space, but this is more on the data center side, which has been a big challenge, a big problem. And it has always been a problem for every data center company, like starting from Google to any other companies, right? And they've always outsourced the product, used external tools to manage this data, to be compliant of audits or whatever it is. And I think that's where what I'm working on is something in-house, which slightly leads towards the platform engineering side of things, right? So that's something I'm working on.
So on that note, platform engineering, what are your thoughts on platform engineering? Like, you know, it's kind of been a trend for the past year. Like, is it all hype? Do you think it's all real? How do you see that role kind of evolving over the next few years?
Okay. So, I think I've read quite a lot of blogs and articles talking about platform engineering as being a hype. It's just being one of the passes. Like, so I think let's start with this. Let's talk about the chronology. Let's understand the chronology here. So there were system admins, and the sysadmins, then they moved on. They were doing the typical routine manual work of getting the data, entering the data, or managing the servers, Linux, configuring them manually, everything, right? Which became very hectic. That's where the DevOps trend started, where they started working with the developers. They started understanding the feedback and improving the overall operations or management of the servers of the ecosystem, right? And with this, they were able to actually improve the entire infrastructure automation. They could build a lot of infrastructure automation. The things like availability, uptime started being more important, right? But in this DevOps, the problem was that the DevOps engineers or the system engineers had lesser knowledge about the application. They were more knowledgeable about the infrastructure, but they had lesser knowledge about what the application is, what it does. So that's when the entire trend started about SRE, where the developers started giving a lot more information about the application, that what the application does, what are the different APIs, how does it work, how to get it running, and everything, right? So SRE started knowing more about the application. They could run the application end-to-end without even requiring a developer because they understand the application very well now. But the problem here with SRE is that it is very difficult to scale SRE, because if you have more number of developer teams, similarly, you need that many number of SRE teams because you have to complement them. So SRE needs to scale, and it is very difficult to scale an SRE. So basically, it's difficult to scale an SRE. That's where the platform engineering thing came, where you develop the code, you deploy the code. And I can build a platform where whatever the SRE practices I was doing earlier for you, I can actually build it in the platform so that whenever you are deploying the code, it will automatically follow some of the best practices. And anytime you want to reach to the advanced level, I'm available for you. So platform engineering is actually a complementing area. It is, I don't think it's the, I mean, of course it's an evolution, but it is not just the next stage. It is a parallel field which has been developed, like from DevOps to SRE. I would say it's the next level, but from SRE to platform engineering, it's an extension that we have, which reduces the overall operational work that SRE still had to do. One of the key pillars of SRE is to remove toil. And SRE started eventually understanding that they cannot remove toil just by writing code, just by automating using Terraforms or Ansibles. They will have to create platforms where the developers themselves can do it. And I think there are some beautiful platforms available. There are no code or low code platforms like Backstage by Spotify. I think when these companies, and I think let's talk about Netflix again. Netflix has an entire team called DevEx, which is developer experience team, which actually creates these tools. They do not call it clearly as a platform engineering, but I think every other team has started creating tools or creating platforms which allows developers to self-service things. I mean, for example, I don't remember the name of this. It starts something. I don't remember this tool, but Netflix has open sourced this tool, which is to manage the entire access management IAM, basically requesting IAM roles or IAM accounts for AWS using a platform. So you can actually place a request. It ensures that your request is going through an approval mechanism. It ensures that you are given the minimum privileges required. Let's say you need to write to a S3 bucket. You're not given any read privileges. You're not given any list privileges because you've only requested for a write privilege. So making sure that minimum privileges are given. And all of this thing is available as a platform. So developers themselves can request it. And if the request is something, I think there is some logic there, but if the request is safe, let's say there's some rules that they've written, it'll automatically get approved. It does not even require an approval. And you can always set those rules. Let's say if the buckets are log buckets and those are safer buckets, you always approve them. No further requirement for this thing. Something of that sort. That's it. Or let's say you are a part of team. Your other team members already have that approval access. So for your request, it will already be approved because you are part of the same team. So it is obvious that you will also require the same privileges. So such things. So these are all platforms. These are all tools which slowly started popping up, and then teams started or companies started to understand that I have too many tools. I have one tool for access management. I have one tool for bucket creation. I have one tool for something else for that matter. Let's say a new microservice creation or boilerplate creation. So why can't I create a single platform which gives all of these services as a single tool? And these are all in a way microservices. Why cannot can I just have those microservices available in a single glass of paint, a single pane of glass? So that's where the entire platform engineering started, the thought process started cultivating. And I think now companies have dedicated platform engineering teams, which are doing amazing work. I think there is Amdocs, and there's so many other companies which are having dedicated and larger teams. In fact, they have much bigger teams. Let's talk about Cisco. I mean, Cisco doesn't really have a platform engineering team as a concept, but there is Cisco IT. And what Cisco IT does is actually very similar to a platform engineering team. They qualify certain products and they say, this is the tool that you will use for, let's say SonarQube is what you will use for all your code quality checks or check marks, or you will use Jenkins for this particular thing. And they manage those Jenkins, those SonarQubes and everything. And they make it available using their in-house tools. So it's not that you go to a link and there is Jenkins. There is a different app store kind of a platform where you can find all the tools managed by IT. And again, it is not the actual platform engineering kind of a way of doing things, but it is very similar to that. So almost every company is realizing that and has gotten to that stage where they have to certain level, a level of maturity, different levels of maturity of the platform engineering. But I am very sure this platform engineering is there to stay. It is a faceless approach to SRE, to DevOps. And I think it improves a lot of operations. It improves a lot of usability for entire team. So sorry, I have too many things to talk about it because I'm a big fan of platform engineering. And I am just wondering what next it brings. And I think with platform engineering, integrating something like GenAI would be very easy now. Without that, I think it would be much difficult. But with platform engineering, just because you already have a platform to auto-complete, to use generative AI to just auto-populate things or fulfill a lot of requirements is much easier now, because it consolidates things together. It understands the end-to-end process. So I think that this is not a trend. This is not a hype. It is a big innovation. It's a big evolution of the entire infrastructure engineering. And it is definitely here to stay and evolve further to a much, much better stage where the engineers, the system engineers would love to, I would love to see where it gets to.
Yeah, I really like the way you explain it, kind of like it's the evolution, like it's something that people were already working on, or, you know, they're scaling, things are getting complicated. They're like, we need to make this make sense. And then we're just kind of observing that this is happening across multiple companies, and then they're calling it platform engineering. Like the name is kind of an observation of what everybody's doing, but like in different ways. I don't know. Am I on the right track with that conclusion, or?
So I'll tell you one thing. So the problem about the hype or the trend that people are saying is that I start a new startup. I want to get to platform engineering right away. But that's not how it should be. You need to evolve to that stage. You may not start with a DevOps engineer from day one. You may start with a developer where you build the application. Now you see that there's a pain. I need a tester. I need a DevOps engineer. And from DevOps, so you have to mature to that stage. So a lot of companies which are new, which is just entering into the tech, and they find this to be a big pain, that how can I build platform? It's so much of pain. It's ever growing. It's always changing. It's always innovating. How do I catch up? So I think they should not catch up. It's not about catching up, but it is more about maturing and evolving to that stage. You have a platform engineering when you need one. You have a DevOps engineer when you need one. You don't start with a DevOps engineer. You don't start with a platform engineering team from day one. So it's more about an evolution, as also what you're trying to say, right? It's more about an evolution. So every company should think of these stages. And of course, there will be a lot more things coming up. I said GenAI integrating into platform and so many things. So it should always be an evolution that teams should consider to getting there, rather than starting to catch up from day one. They'll never be able to catch up if they do that.
Yeah, the way this whole little discussion on it got me kind of excited. Because, you know, it's like something you hear and you're just like, what is that? But your explanation kind of made it make a lot more sense to me. So that was awesome. Well, thank you so much for chatting with us today. Before we sign off, where can people find you if they want to talk some more about IAM or platform engineering and these types of stuff?
I'm always available on LinkedIn. I think LinkedIn is one of the easiest and most professional ways to connect, I think. So I'm not sure if how we can share that, but my LinkedIn ID is linkedin.com/in/krish512krish512, and always ping me. Also, a lot of times I do posts related to something, some new concepts that I've learned, some new philosophies that I've learned, which are very applicable to tech. So I think that's one of the best platforms to reach out to me.
Awesome. Well, you could also find me on LinkedIn as well. K James, I'm sure if you search me up, you'll find my picture. But yeah, thank you so much, Krishna, for joining us and talking today. It was very insightful. To our audience, you could find more about the Living on the Edge podcast on getambassador.io. And thanks for joining us. Thanks for listening today.